From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. We'll dig into the written and visual archives of history today for an important look back at issues that still challenge our society, like civil rights and states' rights. First, though, yesterday's conversation on a new Bigfoot museum in North Georgia inspired you to share some of your close encounters with us. Here are your first thoughts. Tricia O'Keefe reached us on Facebook. She says, "Down my way, I have heard this creature referred to as a chinaberry man or skunk ape because of the peculiar odor of chinaberries he gives off. In fact, one of my cousins had a brush with this creature while hunting down in the woods at night in South Georgia. He heard footsteps as if someone was paralleling his movements. He couldn't see who it was through the foliage. He was wearing a miner's lamp and had a flashlight in his hand. Both had new batteries. Both went out simultaneously. That's when he smelled the fetid odor of chinaberries. He ran all the way to his deer stand and climbed up. Both the lights came back on." Paints a picture, doesn't it? And we also got this message.
"Hi, my name is Michelle, and I talked to someone firsthand that saw a Bigfoot in Georgia in Meriwether County on the back road, not once but twice, and she even was so scared she got in her trunk and closed her trunk. So I believe in them, and there's been a lot of sightings. So she says about 8 feet tall, hairy, and it was walking across the road, and her car went dead, and she got out and got in the trunk."
Always great to hear your story. You can call us at 404-500-9457 like Michelle did. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. The most famous names in the fight for African-American civil rights belong to men: Martin, Malcolm, Jesse, John, Ralph. But of course, women were there all along, behind the scenes and on the front lines. But their stories are still overshadowed or sometimes absent completely from history books. Now there's an opportunity to learn more about them and their efforts to bring racial equality to the U.S. The records of women who are part of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference are now available to the public at Emory University. SCLC Women was founded in 1979 in Atlanta. The headquarters are still here. And we welcome the current interim chair of SCLC Women, Scarlett Presley Brown. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also with us is Sarah Quigley. She's the Emory Manuscript Archivist. Sarah, it's good to have you here as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Scarlett, I want to play you, we have some excerpts from Shirley Chisholm's speech at the SCLC Women's 1984 Women Power Forum. And I want to play you this one because you can hear, in some ways, the frustration in her voice.
"Let's face it. The thrust of the civil rights struggle focused on acknowledging and acting upon the fact that the black man was a full human being. And while black women were certainly expected to prepare the chicken dinners and the sweet potato pies for the strategy meetings and the civil rights marches, rarely, really were they expected or even asked to participate in the planning of these events."
So, Scarlett, the SCLC is not a men's only organization. So why did they need to found SCLC Women?
To ensure that the issues and the importance of women was recognized, that we had a platform, that we had a forum for our voice, and that those things that were relevant were acknowledged.
Can you tell me about the remarkable woman who founded SCLC Women?
The remarkable woman who founded SCLC Women is Mrs. Evelyn Gibson Lowry. She is the wife of Reverend Dr. Joseph Eccles Lowry. And she, in her own right, was one of the most dynamic, most influential, and powerful women of the movement up until the time that she passed away.
And so what is included, Sarah, in the archives that Emory now has?
The collection is primarily the administrative records of SCLC Women as an organization, and that includes planning documents for the programs and the events that they held, like the Woman Power Forum, as well as printed material, flyers, posters, and informational materials that they created to promote those events.
Let's hear another, since you mentioned the Women Power Forum, let's hear from Shirley Chisholm, another dynamic woman speaking at that event back in 1984. And again, this was a powerful speech, but it was also in some ways, it sounds like almost cathartic for Shirley Chisholm. Take a listen.
Black women traditionally for so long have been loyalists in every movement. Loyalists in the black movement, loyalists in the women's movement. But nobody ever accepts the responsibility of helping to have black women emerge as standard bearers in political elections unless the black woman decides in and of herself that she is going to accept that challenge.
So, Scarlett, why do we still need the SCLC Women's Organization?
Because as far as we have come since the speech that Ms. Chisholm made, we still have a long way to go. Even in our current social, civic, and political arenas, it's all that we can do to have our space and our place. Oftentimes, it's a matter of demanding it, taking it, when it should be our basic right to have it. So SCLC Women is still relevant because we make sure that these kinds of issues remain on the forefront, that there is acknowledgement, that there is awareness. And when you heighten the awareness, then you can address it.
What are, Sarah, what are some of the documents that you found that really interesting? Was there anything in there that you went, wow, I can't believe this is in here?
The most interesting part of the collection, in my opinion, are the records that document the National AIDS Program, which was a grant-funded program that SCLC Women ran beginning in around 1986, so very early in the HIV and AIDS crisis. And it was meant to educate African-American communities about the disease, using the church as a central location for conducting outreach and education classes, just as the church has always been central to the civil rights movement.
And 86 is very early on. That's before even our president and government were looking fond. And what's moving, we only have a couple minutes left, Scarlett, but what's moving forward, some of the priorities for the SCLC Women?
Some of our priorities now stem around domestic violence and understanding this is a major issue. That's one of our programs that we continue to host and sponsor every year, taking care of our seniors every year, acknowledging the contribution that they have made, and then our children, that's ongoing. We host a heritage tour every year in March and commemorating Bloody Sunday. And these are the programs that continue to educate. These programs are quite relevant, and we continue to ask for support so that we can maintain these programs.
Asking for support, which is not what Emory's doing. The archive is free and open to the public?
It is, absolutely. Monday through Saturday, 9 to 5.
That is Sarah Quigley, manuscript archivist at the Rose Library at Emory University. Scarlett Presley Brown is the interim chair of SCLC Women. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
An outpouring of love and support has surrounded the nation's LGBTQ community since the tragic massacre at a gay nightclub in Orlando, and activists have received renewed attention to the fight for sexual orientation equality. One of the biggest issues in that fight today has been over bathrooms. The federal government established nationwide guidelines for school bathrooms last month. Its policy states schools that restrict transgender students from using the bathroom of their choice could be cut off from federal funds. That federal directive rubbed many people in Georgia the wrong way. Georgia is part of an 11-state lawsuit against the Obama administration for overreaching its constitutional power. The balance between state and federal power has always been pretty hotly contested, and we wanted to ask the question, what is the current state of states' rights, and how much has it changed over the years? For that, we have Eric Siegel. He's a constitutional law professor at Georgia State University. Hello again, Eric.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Scott Gaylord. He's law professor at Elon University. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the program.
So before we talk about our modern view of states' rights, let's kind of take it back to the founders. This is a clip from a video produced by the Washington Post. They argue that James Madison, one of the founders, was hesitant to give the states too much power.
Madison had a whole critique of the way in which state governments, more than the national government, were likely to pass laws that would be unfair to minorities, maybe religious minorities, maybe racial minorities, maybe the minorities holding large amounts of property. So Madison felt that the smaller the entity, the easier it was to pass unjust legislation.
Eric, you're nodding your head. You'd agree with that characterization?
I think James Madison definitely thought that. He was concerned about factions, local and national. I'll let Scott take this one because he's going to be more sympathetic to 18th
to the argument of the founders.
Well, to 18th century beliefs than I am, yes.
Oh, come on now. And so it begins. Scott.
Hold on.
Scott, is limiting state power to a certain extent part of our constitutional history?
I think it certainly is part of the history. I mean, you can go back prior to the Constitution and the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. I mean, sort of the founders' first attempt to get things to work out. And in the wake of, you know, life under the British monarchy, there was great concern, and the founders were very wary of centralizing power. And as a result, under the Articles, the central government was incredibly weak, and it just didn't work. I mean, it came to the realization that we had to get together. And so the Constitutional Convention back in May of 1787 was really about trying to, at first, amend the Articles of Confederation because they weren't working. But within 5 days, they realized that we need to scrap that altogether and work on the Constitution. And then the disagreements between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists and trying to figure out what the proper balance of power would be came to the forefront. And Madison certainly thought it was important to have both federal and state government, concerned about that balance of power, but really thinking that you'd have the two governments, they would help control each other, that they would have their own spheres of operation, Federalist 51, Federalist 46, and you pit ambition
right
against ambition.
We can't talk about state power versus the federal government without realizing, as the Supreme Court unanimously said, in a case called Mitchum versus Foster, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution were passed specifically to alter the balance of power between the state and federal governments, and to put federal judges, federal officials, and the national government in between the states and the people to the extent the states were violating the people's rights. That is just as important to today's world, more important to today's world than anything that happened in the 18th century.
So the 13th, for those of you who do not have the Constitution memorized, the 13th Amendment was the one that abolished slavery.
Yeah.
The 14th was definition
equal
of citizenship.
And due process. And,
right. Okay. And then the 15th was the right to vote.
Yes.
Protecting the right to
right
vote.
But,
okay.
But a unanimous Supreme Court said right the purpose of that was to alter the balance of power between the state and federal governments.
For oversight purposes.
For all purposes.
Okay, so then let's fast forward a lot to the era of Reagan, former President Reagan. Here he is talking about the relationship of states between state and federal governments when it comes to taxes.
It doesn't make sense to me for the federal government to take that money first and insist that the only solution to our local problems is for them to take the money, and then they dispense it back to you in grants in which they tell you how to spend it from Washington, D.C. And of course, like an agent with a Hollywood actor, there's a certain carrying charge that's deducted in Washington before you get it back again.
Well, that's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous.
Why is that ridiculous?
Well, we can pass a new constitutional amendment if we want to stop the federal government from collecting income tax, but we do have that amendment so they can do that. And after they do that, when they say to the states, as they've done in the LGBT controversy, if you want our money, you have to do X, Y, and Z. But if you don't want our money, you don't have to do X, Y, and Z. And there is nothing unconstitutional about that.
So this means that you feel as though this law, this I'm going to get you, Scott, don't worry.
Sure,
but
no
this
problem.
This dictate from the federal government saying if you want federal funds for your public school, then you have to allow open access to bathrooms for transgender. You feel that's perfectly constitutional, Eric?
Sure. If the states don't want to do that, don't take the money.
Scott, would you agree?
Well, certainly there's a broad power for the federal government with respect to taxing and spending. There's no doubt about that. But the court has expressly said that it's not unlimited. And we see that in NFIB versus Sebelius with respect to the spending powers with Medicaid. And the court imposed limits on the federal government and actually said that you went too far. If you can sort of incentivize states to act or adopt federal policy, but you can't coerce or compel them to do that. And so it depends, as the court has set out in a couple of different cases, it's going to now just seems depend on the amount of pressure
excuse
that's
me, not
put
a couple
on
cases.
The court.
Not a couple cases.
Let Scott finish,
well,
and then we'll get to Eric.
Certainly, South Dakota versus Dole sort of sets that out as well in terms of 0.5% of a state's budget does not constitute coercion, but if you get up to
You're losing me just a little bit, Scott, because I don't know these cases. All you're saying,
sure.
Can I boil it down and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong?
That'd be fine.
It sounds like what you're saying is, yes, the federal government has the power to do with their money they've collected as they will. And yes, they can limit what the states can do before they remove federal government. But as soon as that becomes coercion, then it becomes unconstitutional. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. The choice of the state must be knowing and voluntary. And
right.
So the conditions have to be spelled out clearly, but then the voluntariness comes in, and the court in NFIB versus Avalos, which is the most recent case that Eric is talking about, this condition out there.
Right.
We're trying to see where that limit is.
Before we take a break, Eric, you wanted to respond.
Two quick points. NFIB versus Sebelius was the first case since the New Deal to ever strike down a law under the spending power.
True.
And two, it's incredibly incorrectly decided.
You disagree with the Supreme Court.
Well, of course, because I'm not allowed to say to you, your wallet or your life. That's an unconstitutional choice. If I see you in the alley and I say your wallet or your life,
that's robbery.
I have no right to impose either condition. The federal government has no obligation to give the states any money. When they do so, they can say, take it. Don't take it. I'm not going to kill you if you don't take it. You just lose the money. And that's how the law was until the obviously nakedly political decision in NFIB.
Okay. We're going to dig into this a little deeper and try to see if we can find where these limits of states' rights are and how they relate to us. Eric Siegel, still with us. He's a constitutional law professor at Georgia State University. And Scott Gaylord teaches law at Elon University. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have this lawsuit which is going forward, and Georgia is a party to that, saying that the federal government can't withhold funds for public schools because of access to bathrooms on the part of transgender kids. But there's another issue that I want to bring up that has especially become important lately, and that is gun control. And this is another place, Scott, in which there's arguments over what states can do and what the federal government can do. One of our own listeners, as we were talking about, there's a petition now to ban assault weapons, said, well, why don't we just let the states decide whether to allow assault weapons or not? What do we know about the limits of federal power on that issue?
To me?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think this is certainly trying to figure out in the wake of the Supreme Court's decisions recognizing the Second Amendment right. I think the Ninth Circuit just came out with an important decision saying there was no right to concealed carry, that you had to make a specific showing of need for that. So that's a really important decision in terms of, limitations on what the states can do.
Well, because states disagree on that. Some have more lax rules in terms of who can conceal carry. Is that why you mentioned that?
Correct. That you'd see, to the extent, a lot of these issues, to the extent they're left to the states, obviously, then it gives you that idea of Justice Brandeis, states as laboratories for experiment to try different things and do different things. When the federal government comes in and sets the policy, obviously, that's going to nationalize it for everybody. And the federal government has broad authority under its taxing, spending, and commerce power to regulate lots of things. What we're seeing is seeing situations which states are stepping in and trying to say, well, we want to have control or not. And it's ultimately left to the courts as the last arbiters of all things constitutional to determine what that is. And given the current makeup of the court with, Justice Scalia's passing and the open vacancy, I think these issues can become all more important, not only on the specific issues as to gun control, bathroom access, or anything else, but this larger federalism issue between state and federal authority.
I think the states should be free to regulate guns as they see fit without any constraint from the Second Amendment, which was completely misread by the Supreme Court in Heller for the first time in American history to allow for a constitutional right to own guns. And having said that, I don't think Congress is going to get in this game very much for obvious reasons, including
the gun control game.
So it's even more important that states be allowed, the states that want to, should be allowed to enact pretty much whatever gun reform laws they want to. One more thing about this. If there's ever an issue for states' rights people, it should be guns, because what is needed in Montana and Savannah and New York City and Brooklyn and Chicago are all very different things. And we shouldn't have national rules about this, and we never did.
And yet, Eric, oftentimes the argument for federal oversight, in this case we're talking about the Supreme Court, is that you'll have all these different laws and you'll pass over a state border and what you can carry in your car changes and what you can have in your cell phone contract changes. So often the argument for federal oversight is that states' laws are all over the map.
It's a great point. But that's when we need uniformity for economic sake or for future planning's sake. And it's always a balance anyway. If Chicago thinks, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, if Chicago thinks the city is going to have less murders with less guns, whereas Fayetteville thinks it's going to have less murders with more guns. Either community should be allowed to make that decision free of any constitutional constraint, because the Second Amendment had nothing to do with this. The Second Amendment was a well-regulated militia, and from 1781 until 2008, virtually every court in the United States said that. So all I'm suggesting is, if there was ever an issue that should be decided locally, it is the relationship between guns and safety.
So, Scott, how does this – let's bring this back to this lawsuit that to which Georgia is a party in terms of access to bathrooms by transgender students. Does federal oversight possibly step in here in terms of, A, the fact that the federal government has the constitutional power to control its own funds, and, B, that some oversight by the federal government is needed in some cases to protect minorities?
I mean, certainly that's the central issue here. And in terms of the federal government's ability to do that, they need to do that within constitutional parameters as well. So the federal government's power is not unlimited. And to the extent one disagrees with NFIB versus Sebelius, that's fine. But it is the governing Supreme Court precedent. And that precedent says that there are limits on the federal government's spending power. Title IX is supported through the Congress's spending power. And so if they're going to exert that and threaten to withhold all Title IX money, which, you know, the Human Rights Campaign suggests it's about $4.5 billion in Title IX funds for North Carolina. Texas has said it's more than $10 billion.
I want to make sure everyone is still with you. Title IX is the clause that says no American should be excluded from participation in educational activities because of their sex or the basis of
by entities receiving federal funds.
Right.
Funds.
It's not a general
directly
rule.
To the
right.
It's the spending power. Correct.
Right.
It's supported by the fact that, as Eric mentioned, the federal government's giving you this money. If you want that money, then the claim is you do what we want you to do, and if not, we'll take our money and go home.
I want to be clear. I never said there were no limits on the spending power. What I said is the limit, for instance, the condition has to be clear. Scott and I agree on that. The condition
correct.
Has to be clear. What I disagree with is that there's the coercion element that NFIB added for the first time in American history as a holding, not as a dictum, but as a holding. That element of it doesn't make any coherent sense. Take the money, don't take the money. If it's up to you, then it's not coercive. And it is up to North Carolina. They can, or Georgia, they can refuse this money. They are allowed to refuse this money.
We could, but then that's a huge amount of the budget. And we've only got a couple minutes left. You wanted to say something else, Scott?
Oh, just to say, I mean, it's true. There's sort of the choice at some level, but what the court has said is that it's a gun to the head of state. So just like the Medicaid funding was, when you're removing all of that, it's such a high amount that it's really not freedom of choice, and it's a conscripting the states into what the court talked about as the national bureaucratic army. And at least under
NFIB,
that's not permitted.
Just to be devil's advocate here, not that Eric isn't enough of one, but in the last minute what we have, that's because Georgia has chosen to rely on federal funds, right? I mean, Georgia
yes.
could give
sure,
more money to the public
but
schools.
Again, this condition wasn't there, and another concern in NFIB is whether or not you can change the conditions ex post. And, you know, Title IX was set out in 1972. It's not clear. This interpretation is relatively recent. Is that a change? That'll be another issue that the courts have to address.
But that changes
in
all
the
time.
Current decisions.
States, and this is, in the Medicaid case, actually, the states were told it's going to change. That's even another reason that case was so frivolous. But states know that vague terms in statutes, as interpreted by executive agencies, the meaning is going to change over time, and they agree to be bound by the legal changes that happen in that sense.
Okay. Obviously, the discussion over what state rights means continues in the United States. Eric Siegel is a constitutional law professor at Georgia State University. Scott Gaylord is a law professor at Elon University. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank
you,
for
Scott.
The program.
Thanks.
Thank you, Eric. Have a great day, everybody.
You too.
Photographer Walker Evans documented a poetic and poignant, sometimes heartbreaking view of America through his lens. Evans is considered one of the most influential American photographers of the 20th century. There's now a new exhibition at Atlanta's High Museum that looks back at his 50-year career. Brett Abbott curated that show, and he joins me in our studio. Good to see you again.
Wonderful to see you.
And also with us is Duke University professor and photographer Alex Harris. He is originally from Atlanta, and he studied under Walker Evans. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Celeste. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. Let's let the man speak for himself first. This is Walker Evans in an interview that was released by the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles, describing his view of photography.
I believe the achievement of a work that is evocative and mysterious and at the same time realistic is a great one and a rare one. And perhaps sometimes almost an accident. It's akin to hunting, photography is.
Alex, what advice did he give you on achieving that happy accident that he's describing there?
You know, Walker really made it clear to us in class. I took a seminar from him as a junior at Yale, that the object of photography is not really to draw attention to yourself as a photographer, but to try to come as close as you can to the thing itself, to the thing that you're looking at, to the experience that you're having. And he basically said, look, you know, when you're young, you don't want your work to spring from studying the work of famous photographers or going to magazines or the gallery. You really want your work to spring from the life, what he called the life of the streets. And essentially, I think what he was saying to us is get out of the classroom, get beyond the walls of the university, have your own relationship with the world, discover what interests you, and let your work spring from your relationship to that subject.
So in curating this exhibit, or just knowing Walker Evans, and many people will know his work from all the photos he took of the Depression, this is a guy who grew up wealthy. And yet had such an eye for what it meant to be poor. How do you, Brett, how do you understand that process? How did that happen?
Well, great question. I think that, you know, he showed throughout his life a real interest in the vernacular, in something that was very authentic about America. That started from a very early period when he was looking at scenes on the streets of New York, and then sort of moving to vernacular expressions in architecture. And all of that took place before he ever did this work during the Great Depression. I don't know exactly where that impulse came from, but it was something that stayed with him throughout his entire career.
Many people will group his work with Dorothea Lange's, whose photos are also very iconic of the Depression era. What's the difference between those two photographers?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're in many ways two of the most important photographers of the Depression. They were working in different areas of the country mostly. Evans's work is very quiet. It's very straightforward. It has a kind of subtle lyrical quality to it. It feels easy at first, but as you look at the pictures, they become more and more complex. There's this sophistication underlying the composition of everything that he did that was really, really wonderful. Lange had a slightly different approach. I think her pictures have a little bit more, in some way, emotion to them, a little bit more of a sense of candid capture and less perhaps structure.
So let's hear Walker Evans again. This is from that interview from the J. Paul Getty Museum in L.A. And yes, his work has been used for political purposes. This is him commenting on that.
The work produced in the Depression looks like social protest. It wasn't intended to be. It wasn't intended to be used as propaganda for any cause. I suppose I was interested in calling attention to something and even shocking people. But I don't think I had the purpose of improving the world.
Alex, what kind of relationship should a photographer, according to Walker Evans, should a photographer have with social movements and social protest and politics?
You know, in a sense, I think what Walker's saying is it almost doesn't matter what you think or feel politically or in terms of social causes. If you're a photographer who's trying to see the world in an authentic way, not as propaganda, but as the way things are, as the way you really see them, then your pictures will speak for themselves. And sometimes the photographs that yell the loudest are the ones that affect us the least. It's the quiet pictures like those that Walker made that make you think, gosh, this is the way things really are. And no one behind the camera is trying to manipulate me. They're showing me society as it is.
And yet, Brett, he had this uncanny ability to shock people with these photos that seemed so simple, as you say. When you're mm-hmm. looking at that as a piece of art, how does that work?
Well, they feel at times so easy, almost as though they were meant
as though
to
it
be.
Was an accident. He just
as
turned
though it
and
was
just
an
snapped
accident.
A picture.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm thinking of this one portrait that he did on the streets of New York. It was shot in a candid way. There's a woman looking across the street. She has a black hat on. And it feels so easy and candid. But then as you look at this picture, you realize that there are these wonderful, perhaps happy accidents. Perhaps it was something that he just intuitively felt when he made the picture. But the buildings behind her reflect the kind of white of her face and the dark of her hat behind her. You have these all of these lines around her face that serve to frame up her face for the viewer. It's very subtle. You don't notice them unless you spend a lot of time with this picture. But once you realize that all of these structures are there to make this picture feel so direct, you realize that he had this really sophisticated approach to picture making that was very quiet but very effective.
It's just a master of framing. That's a High Museum curator, Brett Abbott. He is behind the new exhibit with renowned photographer Walker Evans' photos. We also have been speaking with one of Evans' former students, Atlanta native Alex Harris, who studied with Evans. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
The exhibit is on display now through September 11th at the High Museum in Atlanta. That is our show for today, but we will have, I promise you, another great show tomorrow, and that is because of you. It's because of your support for GPP and your dedication to public radio. Donations, gifts from listeners like you help us connect you to the most interesting stories and the most interesting voices in the state. You are just a phone call or click away from the chance to join our team and help the station stay strong.